After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, visit www.beherenownetwork.com/Sharon. Enjoy listening.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm joined by Dr. Jenny Tates for today's episode of the Metta Hour podcast. Jenny is board certified in cognitive behavioral therapy and a licensed clinical psychologist in New York and California. Jenny has a private therapy practice based in LA and serves as a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA. Her writing has appeared in numerous prominent publications, including the New York Times and Time Magazine, and she's the author of two books, and Emotional Eating, and her 2018 release, How to Be Single and Happy, Science-Based Strategies for Keeping Your Sanity While Looking for a Soulmate. Welcome to the podcast, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me, Sharon. It's a real honor to talk to you.
Well, it's a great delight. I'm going to start by congratulating you on your new book. It came out at the start of the year, and I love the title, How to Be Single and Happy, Science-Based Strategies for Keeping Your Sanity While Looking for a Soulmate. So some of my friends once formed what they called the Happy Singles Club, rather than thinking of their singledom as a kind of lesser state, to see it as kind of it was something that existed. There was the truism of their life at that time, and that why not be happy instead of feeling you did not have the thing you needed to have. So I wondered if you could tell the listeners out there how you came to this work and how you found your path around it.
Well, this is such a uniquely wonderful experience because you actually helped a lot with this process. When I was working on my book proposal, I reached out to you and had a really meaningful conversation that really stayed with me and was sort of the central thesis of my book about, you know, really asking yourself. This is the advice you gave me when we sat down for tea in your apartment maybe 2 years ago at this point. You know, really thinking to yourself, like, how would your life be different if you had a partner? Would you carry yourself differently? Would you treat yourself differently? Would you carry yourself with less shame? Would you pursue different life experiences? And really considering, you know, just doing that without a partner because it's totally a story that we tell ourselves that we need a plus one to live fully. And I guess I came to this work predating our conversation a little bit, just really noticing in with a lot of my patients this real challenge of everything seems to be going well except looking for love can feel like a full-time job that's not rewarding. And I entirely relate to that process because I dated for a long time in New York City and Los Angeles and can empathize with how, you know, you can easily fall into feeling like there's something wrong with you if you're not feeling connected to someone and it could easily lead to sort of not feeling connected to yourself. So both kind of professionally seeing it with my patients and having the personal sort of understanding of the experience made me think that this was really a topic that hadn't been covered sort of with a scientific lens. And I was really sort of shocked by some of the research on how happy marriage makes us. And it's pretty modest. So that sort of like conversations between, talking to you and talking to other experts really made me think that, you know, common understanding about relationships and what people think privately are at odds. And I want people to feel empowered to know that there's a lot of happiness within their hands, regardless of who's sitting next to them at the table.
I'm wondering, you know, I keep sort of reading about the prevalence of loneliness in America, now England. They did a study. I think in England they have a minister of loneliness or somebody that who's in charge of combating it, something like that. This is something you tackle in the book. Here's a quotation from you. And part of it I'm going to follow with needing a definition. Christopher Massey and a team of researchers at the University of Chicago analyzed more than 77 research studies to pinpoint what created feelings of loneliness. They found that maladaptive social cognitions, or negative thoughts related to interpersonal situations, were strong predictors of loneliness, and that thinking differently turned out to be the most powerful way to feel more connected. So the definition that would help me is maladaptive social cognitions. What is that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's these thoughts that come up when we are with other people that either, you know, keep them apart from us or keep us apart from them, sort of thoughts like we have nothing in common when you first meet someone and you barely even know the person's name and you sort of conclude that there's really no point or you're too busy. These thoughts that just quickly sort of spontaneously arise when we face someone new. And it doesn't matter how many people are around if your mind is sort of creating these obstacles and these barriers that keep you apart from someone else, whether that's stories about you being better than them or them being better than you or, you know, sort of thoughts about what you're going to say that make you feel like you have, there's no way you're ever going to have a meaningful conversation with someone. So it's really fascinating. I mean, people have this false sense that a romantic relationship is the cure for loneliness, but it's actually targeting this concept of maladaptive social cognitions.
So if it's sort of a distorted way of thinking about ourselves, thinking about our lives, that's really a strong indicator of loneliness, it would be independent of relationships. And it would also speak to the power of mindfulness, I suppose, to see what your mind is doing and to be able to remind yourself, well, that's just an old tape or that's an old pattern or I can well let go of that, something like that.
Absolutely, and I think mindfulness is one of the biggest remedies for loneliness because you could maybe quickly catch on to that sort of old tape when you're with someone before you sort of let that tape dictate your behavior, like, you know, walk away from a conversation or quickly sort of write someone off and you really think through, oh, that's just something that my mind is, mental sort of spam that my mind's creating rather than an accurate prediction.
And I don't think it's actually... I don't think it excludes kind of changes in behavior, right? So, like, I was thinking of kind of a current emphasis that I'm hearing about on the dissolution of various social entities in today's America, for example, which I, you know, quoted in my book, Real Love. Robert Putnam, who wrote the book Bowling Alone, about the dissolution of things like bowling leagues, you know, places we used to come together and things like that, which are kind of fading. And so we might have to face some fears, I would think, in order to go out and make a point of connecting in a very conscious way.
Yeah, absolutely. And a big sort of aim of the therapies that I specialize in is really not waiting to feel sort of like less anxious, because that could take many years or your whole life, but to be willing to sit mindfully with some of those uncomfortable emotions and continuing to sort of connect with someone, especially if you can maybe change the goal rather than instead of trying to be liked or the most charismatic person at the party, just trying to maybe offer a kind word or look for the good in someone next to you.
Mm-hmm. So, well, the first goal is getting to the party, right?
Yeah.
And then defining or, I guess, reframing what satisfaction is or success so that it's not so much in the hands of others, but it's really in your own hands.
Yeah, exactly. And it's linked to sort of like a higher purpose rather than a goal that's harder to sort of measure and achieve.
Well, it must be interesting in terms of technology, because the measurement is there, like how many likes did I get, or how many whatevers did I get, or how often was I retweeted, or something like that. And to understand that, oh, that's a path to a lot of suffering, would seem important.
Yeah. We have so many ways to feel rejected and so many ways to feel judged, like online and in real life.
Well, let's talk about just getting to the party to begin with, you know, because if a lot of those social arrangements are not so prevalent anymore, we have to put out extra effort to find them. Where does that extra effort come from? You know, it hopefully would come from a kind of self-compassion and wisdom or understanding of like, oh yeah, maybe it wouldn't have been this hard in another context, but this is the context of this time. And I mean, it's hard to get people to have a conversation. Like, I am strongly entranced by my phone, let's say that, instead of addicted. And, you know, as you might know from whenever we go out together. But, you know, nonetheless, I do see the irony of never talking to the person you're with, you know, because you're on your phone. And so it takes like an extra effort. Somebody said to me not too long ago that they used to love living in New York because you just have these odd conversations with somebody sitting next to them on the bus or in a park bench or something like that. And you just like relate in a way and find out things about people and about life. And so now everyone's on their phone, you know, so you just sit there. And, you know, so it takes some effort to really have a sense of connection or meeting with people.
Yeah, it really does. And there's this this idea in the therapies that I practice that a lot of times to manage anxiety, we use what's called safety behaviors, like things to make us feel more comfortable. Like maybe it's easier for someone to, give a speech if they have like a massive bottle of water that's unnecessary between mm-hmm. them and the microphone. And so I think in a lot of ways, technology has become sort of this like sort of quote unquote safety behavior where we feel more comfortable if we're at the party, but we're, you know, glued to the phone and we're texting. So we don't mm-hmm. really like have the anxious moment of trying to meet eyes with someone and feeling like our, you know, efforts weren't reciprocated. But the problem with safety behaviors is that we don't learn that we're safe without them.
Right.
And it's so comfortable, you know, to some degree to hold on to your phone. And I love that you sort of disclose that, how tempting it is for you, because I think that's so validating for me and for everyone out there that knows this is sort of an issue. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, the thing that people most want is to feel really seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be when I would teach people about validation and I would tell them to like make eye contact, they would like look at me like, oh yeah, duh, like everyone knows that you have to make eye contact to make someone feel seen and heard. But with technology, we have like so many ways to not make someone feel like they matter. So even that, like even sort of having this stance of I want to be compassionate towards myself and I want to be compassionate to other people, so I'm going to try to like, you know, introduce myself to one person that looks like they might need a warm hello at this new party or this mm-hmm. new social networking thing mm-hmm. in real life. That might be a really nice way to sort of move outside your comfort zone.
What would you describe? I mean, when I was younger, we used to talk about people being shy. Would you talk about that as anxiety now? Or?
Well, I think some people are more introverted and some people are more extroverted. But I think now with this idea of maladaptive social cognition, that would maybe be more like anxiety. Like if there's one thing, I guess, if it's a preference, like does a person prefer to sort of, have a more, night on their own versus be with other people? Is it, you know, more of a preference, or is it more that you have this story that if you went out, you wouldn't be well-liked, or mm-hmm. you would feel mm-hmm. alone, or there's no point because no one there would, you know, be a good person to connect with. Mm-hmm. So I think really doing some soul searching and seeing it's certainly okay to prefer to be on your own. And that's sort of a big message that I want people to feel from reading my book, that, you're enough and you don't need to surround yourself with people. Mm-hmm. But also we're social beings and we do sort of need communities, and feeling connected and having a sense of social support is actually more linked to wellness than, if you had the choice of giving up smoking cigarettes, which I recommend because it's a self-compassionate thing to do, mm-hmm. Or connecting with people. Connecting with people is a stronger predictor of longevity, so that it's actually it's a life-saving thing to have a strong sense of community and relationships.
Like, I had read somewhere that that sense of social connection is not based on the sheer numbers of friends you have, but it's how connected you feel. And so, because of course, coming myself from a Buddhist tradition and having the idea of, people not necessarily engaging in the world in the ordinary way, or when I've gone on a 3-month retreat, for example, which is the longest retreat I've been on, it's a silent retreat form. And so the only person I talk to is the teacher. And yet I feel very connected to the people around me, even though we're not engaging in ordinary social discourse. And I feel very connected to the world. I don't know the details of what's happening, and it's usually nice not to know for a little period. But I care. I don't feel like I've dissolved those connections. And if anything, they get reinforced in that silence and just that sense of presence. And so, sometimes people say, and perhaps it's true to some degree, I don't know what the research actually is, that if you've got one friend and you've got an illness, try to make 3 new friends. I don't know if that's true, but I have read that it's really not the numbers, but more the sense of connection.
Absolutely, and I think that gets into, I think this is speaking to the remedy for maladaptive social cognition. It's this adaptive sense of meta connection. So I certainly couldn't agree with you more, and I think this is a really powerful example for people that put a lot of pressure on themselves to sort of be the most charismatic, entertaining person, that it's really just about being in a headspace of connection and giving people sort of non-judgmental stance and being compassionate towards yourself. And you don't even have to speak. I mean, it's just a sense of kindness and grace and noticing without sort of filling the space with words that can create a sense of community and closeness.
Do you think that history goes through phases where sometimes it's more okay to be single and other times it's less okay to be single? And how would you, if so, what do you think about this time?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it seems like this is a weird time that there's this really great movement towards women's equality and feminism. Mm-hmm. And I'm really finding that even with this sort of cultural shift towards empowering women and seeing women as enough, there is sort of this fixation just in day-to-day conversations with questions why is this person still single, or these popular sort of shows or magazine covers that really concerned with people's romantic status, that's their sense of worthiness. And so I'm hoping that this time there's sort of a shift with the increase in sort of feminism, but it seems a lot of the people that I see still sort of feel plagued by this sense of there's something about being single that feels stigmatized.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of remarkable to me anytime I look at a magazine cover how women's relationship status seems to be. So, a person in the popular eye becomes separated or divorced. It's the headlines of the news, and it's just sort of heartbreaking that women continue to sort of be defined by their romantic situation.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So, it reminds me, of course, of my own work when I wrote Real Love, for example, which was my most recent book, and talked about love not as a thing someone else can give us, and also not something someone can take away from us, but a capacity within ourselves that could ignite and does ignite in, presence of certain people or art or music or just, a kind of intentionality, like you say, thank someone today, smile at someone today, you know, go the extra step to being in conversation with a stranger, say something like that. There's so many ways it's possible to bring forth that real experience of love that are not dependent on either a romantic relationship or even dependent on somebody responding in a certain way.
I love that, and I have to tell you that I, when I was deciding whether or not I should write this book, I took a few minutes and I just looked on like the Amazon best-selling books in the dating genre, and I was just like sort of, and I encourage your audience members to do the same, and I was sort of shocked by like, I try to practice non-judgmental stance, so I'm not going to call out any names, but I was sort of shocked by some of the titles that didn't seem very like sort of respectful or compassionate, headlining the dating genre. Yeah. And one of the things that brought me so much joy was seeing sort of like real love at the top of the dating bestsellers list. And it was sort of like this really exciting moment where hopefully, like, you know, the combination of real love and other books that are more compassionate and sort of empowering to women and men as well who are not coupled will sort of create a trend towards more acceptance and sense of respecting everyone regardless of their partnership status.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a long time, I mean, not that long in terms of when you were writing the book, given how long a book takes to get published, but for a while now, although no longer, my book on Amazon was entangled with some dating book because I went from, I don't know, like 40 reviews to 400 reviews. And the comments were things like, this guy is just trying to teach people how to catch babes. And I go, what? You know, like, so it took like a long time in relative terms to get Amazon to respond. Like, wait a minute.
Wow.
You've gotten me confused. You've enmeshed with somebody else. So now we're apart again, he and
yes.
I.
And, I love it.
My book is just standing on its own with its own message.
I love it, but yeah, and I think it's so like wonderful, like the message that you mentioned about community and the sense that even at a silent retreat you could feel so connected, because I think a lot of times people look to love to sort of fill a personal void.
Mm-hmm.
And really learning through mindfulness and other sort of practices to be connected to yourself is, I think, the healthiest way to actually find the love within yourself and also with other people.
Mm-hmm. It's so great. So you're a mom.
I'm a mom, yes.
And do you see like the kind of conditioning that your kids are getting as being influential and different in terms of being able to hang out with themselves, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like, you know, clinical psychology couldn't have been a more interesting sort of like area of study, because it's, you know, I certainly try to use all the things I teach my patients myself and also at home with my kids, and I really try. It's so tempting, especially for people that are busy with their careers. And, you know, I find myself, you know, being preoccupied with trying to catch up with work and writing and respond to patient calls, to really try to sort of validate my children and give them sort of like this quality time without distraction, and realizing that that's like the ultimate gift more so than, big vacation once a year, but sort of daily like quality time in a sense of noticing and honoring their emotions rather than trying to quickly change them or fix them. And I really want to raise my children to feel like they're enough without getting caught up in the maladaptive social cognitions that are so common in schools and in sort of social circles, especially as sort of kids grow up.
And you have one boy and one girl, is that right?
Yeah, I have a one-year-old baby boy and I have a three-year-old girl.
Do you see differences? Well, I guess every kid is different anyway, but I'm curious, you know, beyond or before the kind of intense social conditioning, just in their nature?
You know, one thing that I absolutely love about my daughter, who's little older than my son, is that she goes up to people with this, like, joyful curiosity and enthusiasm and just says hello to everyone. She'll be, like, walking down the street and says, hello, hello, and she wants to stop everyone, and she doesn't care if they want to say hello back to her. She continues to say hi to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really never want to take that away, and it's sort of sad how we take that away from ourselves with sort of thinking, like, oh, should I say hi if I met this person before, and, like, mm-hmm. they should say hello to me, or should I call this person if I called them last time? And I sort of,
Interesting.
Yeah, I think my goal is really to sort of preserve this, like, sense of, like, I want to say hello to people because I could make them feel seen and important, and I want to do that regardless of whether or not they, they seem happy to hear from me or not.
Mm-hmm.
Or they've given me the clue that it's they'll give me the same. I think like a lot of us are born with this sense of like connection to other people, but then unfortunately that gets lost through painful experiences, potentially along the way. But we could at any point sort of pivot and sort of approach people with a sort of beginner's mind and approach ourselves with mm-hmm. sort of that story.
Well, I started my book, Real Love, with kind of the laying out the belief I had in the principle that love was a capacity within ourselves, and that, you know, as I said, other people may ignite it or inspire it or threaten it, but ultimately it was within us, it's ours, and that no one can actually take it away as a capacity. And I ended the book, it took me a long time to write the book, so this was some years later, with an extension of that notion. So it's like, if love is like an ability or a capacity inside us, then isn't it also our responsibility? Like, if you want to have love in a day, maybe you have to introduce it in some conversation. You know, if you want it in an encounter, maybe you have to be the one to bring it forth, or whatever it is. And that if we do claim it as a capacity within ourselves, then it is up to us to tender it and generate it and sort of nourish it in all those ways.
Yeah, I love it, and I couldn't agree with that sentiment more, and I think that this is a huge sort of part of the science of feeling connected to people, that love is really a kind of a behavior rather than a gift people give us. But do we want to behave lovingly to ourselves and other people?
Well, given that media is going to all pretty much go the other way, you know? When you're working with clients, do you talk about, say, the use of social media and more maybe temperate ways to use it, or kind of mainstream media and how to analyze what you're looking at and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my patients actually bring up with me sort of noticing that they maybe like feel more alone and more isolated, and social media is a great way to sort of just like fill yourself with ideas that you've somehow been excluded, or you're mm-hmm. you know, not being invited to these fabulous events that people are posting their photos of. So I think really thinking through like what's a healthy relationship for yourself, and you know, if you feel fulfilled by sending sort of like an email versus picking up the phone and calling. And I think it's a lot more comfortable sometimes to just use sort of social media as a way to keep in touch. And sometimes that's great, but I think it's also really nice to sort of like be with people in real time, in real life, to feel even more connected. But I have to get back to something you said, which I thought was so fabulous. You said that you sort of used to find yourself as shy.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear, because I find myself so inspired by you and your work and your sharing your personal story. How did you, I know a little bit because I'm a big fan of your work, but I would love to hear again in real time how you sort of came to sort of connect so deeply. I mean, for someone who notices feeling sort of a little bit more private to then come forth and travel around the world. And I joke with you when I speak to you that you're like on a perpetual world tour.
Yeah, I know.
giving your teachings and for, you know, full days. Because I think this will teach so many people, and I will certainly relay this message to my patients of like, because I think a lot of people sort of write themselves off as like, this is just how I am, and they're not able to sort of step outside of their comfort zone. So I was just wondering mm-hmm. how you came to do that.
Well, I mean, I think you were completely correct and very wise in talking about, you know, there's a difference between being an introvert, which I also am, and having some maladaptive social cognitions, or if I got that right. So, I mean, some people are more introverted, and you know, it's sort of like this is an interesting time with Susan Cain's work and, you know, the recognition that some people are more introverted. Like, I would much rather send a text than a phone, than call somebody. And I joke, it came up, I guess I said it because you said something about networking. And I thought about those times people urge me to, you know, pay a lot of money to go to some conference where I'm not really speaking, but it'll be a chance to network. And I think, network, I'm going to sit in my room, you know, like that's not going to happen. I'll probably watch some of it online too, you know, like that would be a complete waste of money. There are other ways of holding back or being cut off that are not just a kind of personal preference. And I think the personal preference is fine. It's like we might as well have some peace in our lives, and however that's going to be defined, you know, whether it's an all-night party or sitting in your room and having dinner there. But, you know, there are ways in which I talk about sometimes like how when I first began teaching meditation, you know, the form of our intensive retreats, which was the only form we started with, is one where people practice all day and there's individual teacher contact or there's questions and answers and things like that. But there's only one kind of real lecture, which happens at night. And I could not give that talk. I couldn't give the lecture. I was too overcome with fear. And the first retreat that we were invited on as a kind of collective to teach was a month-long retreat. So I didn't give a single talk for the month. And I was working with my friend Joseph Goldstein. And people used to go up to Joseph and kind of yell at him, like, why won't you let her have a voice? Why won't you let her speak? And he said, I'd be perfectly happy if she gave a talk. It's just like, talk to her. She won't do it. I just couldn't do it. I was terrified. And part of what I was terrified about was the thought that I was going to be giving the talk and I'd be like in the middle of a sentence and my mind would just go blank. And I would just be sitting there. I wouldn't know what to say. And everyone would judge me and it would be so terrible. And then, you know, months and months went by, and then I had the thought, you know, there is this other meditation technique aside from mindfulness, which is called loving kindness, and which I had not really done intensively at that point, but I knew about it. And I thought, you know, there's a guided meditation that goes along with loving kindness. So if I were to do the talk on that topic and my mind went totally blank, I wouldn't have to sit there for very long because I could just launch into the guided meditation. Maybe no one would even realize what had happened. And so I began giving one talk. It was the only talk I could give, which was on loving kindness. And at home in Massachusetts, I had piles and piles and piles of cassette tapes of me giving one talk. And then one day, and this was also a long time later, I thought, you know, they're all kind of loving kindness talks because they're all about connection. Like no one's really sitting there, you know, to hear my brilliant expertise on anything. But we're sitting there because we all want to connect. And I wanted genuinely to connect with them. I knew they wanted to connect with me. They've been practicing all day. They wanted a sense of being a part of something, and a sense of a human family. And so I thought, oh, you know what? They're all about connection. They're all about loving kindness. That's what they all are. That's the real point, you know. So what if I make a mistake? I can also acknowledge that. Or so what if my mind goes blank? I could say, hey, my mind went blank for a moment. Where was I? I've been teaching, I guess it was Bob Thurman recently. I was teaching with Bob, and he would go on some brilliant but strange detour. And then he'd say, he'd look up and he'd say, what's my point? And I go, I don't know. Like, you know, it's like we're just all there together. Is the vibe, and that's the sense that loving kindness gives us. And I realized, oh, they're all like loving kindness talks. They're all just about connection. And from that day on, I could give talks. So it'd be that kind of example. Like, and people I know who are my students will tell me, you know, they're really nervous and they have stage fright and they have these terrible debilitating conditions of anxiety and they have to perform. You know, they're musicians or they're poets or something like that. And And they say they will stand up on that stage and they will start with silently doing a loving kindness meditation for everyone who's out there. So there isn't such a strong sense of us and them, and they're, you know, sitting out there waiting to get me and judge me. It's like, here we are together having an experience.
I love this, and I'm so grateful to hear you talk about this, because it's, I think, for people like myself that have heard you speak and know that you're such an incredible person who shares so heartfully and doesn't seem to be stumped by any question. It's such a nice thing to know that, like, mm-hmm. of course your mind told you that you had nothing to say and you mm-hmm. couldn't talk, because that's just what our minds do, and you could sort of decide that it's your value of connection or compassion is going to transcend sort of the story of your mind. And I similarly could share, which a lot of my clients find surprising, that I also feel sort of like a bit introverted at times and, you know, would much prefer to sort of have dinner on my own at a conference mm-hmm. versus go to a big sort of networking dinner party of sorts. And I think a huge part of sort of self-compassion and preventing and reducing experiences of loneliness is giving yourself space to, like, honor how you feel without judging that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to quote you, and you can give us commentary on what comes up in your mind. This is from your book, and you're tackling the notion of happiness and reexamining how we measure success in the pursuit of that happiness. And what you're saying is that instead of measuring our success by our goals, they can instead be defined by our values. And here's a quotation. We all need a clear sense of purpose, one that comes from our values, not our goals. Values are not the same as goals. With a goal, we win or lose, get it or not. With values, if we're acting consistently with our aims, we can cherish a sense of mastery, independent of the end result. Values aren't measured by what we get, but by what we give.
Yeah, I mean, I just love this idea of people really focusing on what's within their control and what they offer versus what they're receiving. And I think it's just a much more, like, achievable space to live in if you're focused sort of on, can I be interested in someone else and be respectful of someone else and not judge myself, versus can I be the most liked person, or can this person ask me on a third date, and worrying sort of, instead of sort of focusing endlessly and in a circular way on whether or not someone likes you or whether or not you did a good job at the job interview, which is so understandable to worry about because we're social beings and we want to do well, but to focus on, did I do, you know, the best I can, and am I treating myself in this moment with self-compassion if those are your values?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we can't, you know, I think you talk about, you've talked about sort of trying to be like the, forget exactly how you say it, like the director and the producer of someone else's story. And
mm-hmm.
is that how you say it? That we're always, you know, coming up with like what someone's thinking of us, what, you know, what they're going to think of what we think of them. And it's just sort of this circular, unhelpful narrative. And what if instead we just focus on, can we try to be kind and both to others and ourselves? And that seems so much more peaceful and strategic than trying to be like hilarious and smart and perfect, which is such a false critical space to try to perfect.
Well, don't you think one of our greatest maladaptive social cognitions is a sense of perfectionism?
Absolutely, and I think it's so ironic because people that don't really like people that are perfect. I mean, there's something about being vulnerable and being imperfect that's so endearing and connecting. And so I just think it's like this crazy trap we get into because we can't be ourselves, and then people won't really know us, and they also won't really like us because it's kind of intimidating to be with someone that seems perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think compassionate is a much better stance, or kind, or I don't know, patient, listening, something that's within your hands, like a virtue. And, you know, a big part of my work is really helping people articulate their values and really thinking about what, you know, how you want to be remembered or how you want to be celebrated. And I've never heard anyone say that they want to be celebrated as being, you know, the perfect, you know, third date or the perfect. But it's really something about being kind and And a lot of people that are incredibly wonderful people have, you know, like, I don't know, Steve Jobs just came to mind. He has nicely written about in, you know, his commencement speeches that he's given in, I think, when was it Stanford, about how, you know, imperfections have led to his sort of building his perfect devices that keep us disconnected.
Right.
I think it's, you know, it breaks my heart to hear people tell me stories about ruminating about their perceived mistakes in social interactions. And it's just like, that's such a painful space that's going to create loneliness more so than romantic connection.
Hmm. Well, see, back to public speaking, you know, I was thinking about this time I told Pema Chodron, Ani Pema Chodron, who's, of course, you know, a great, great teacher, about my fears and how terrified I was about giving a talk because I thought my mind would go blank. And she said, oh, I always used to be afraid that what would happen to me would be I would be talking on one subject and then my mind would just leap to another subject and I'd go on that second subject without realizing I'd done that. And she said, in all these years, no one has ever come up to complain to me and said, you know what, you were talking about A and then you started talking about B. How dare you? You know, it's like, you're right. People... even if anyone noticed, which is questionable, people aren't, you know, sitting out there with their scorecard, you know, really, you know, like it's OK to be yourself and not be so perfect.
Yeah, it's kind of it's really remarkable. I mean, I've sometimes had patients that say that feel really anxious about asking a former employer to be a reference in their new job search or asking someone for feedback if they feel like the person's mad at them. And it's really remarkable how our minds come up with these worst-case scenarios that couldn't be farther from the truth,
mm-hmm.
And that people are generally, like, have, you know, our best intentions in mind. And it just reminds me, I remember I had this funny experience where a classmate of mine in graduate school worked in the Office of Admissions. And I casually said to him, I was like, oh, that's so funny. You have access to, like, all the notes that, you know, the admissions committee takes during our, you know, during our, like, interviews. And I remember being incredibly anxious the day of my interview and feeling like I did not articulate myself at all and that I was sounding, like, incoherent and not smart and all these stories my mind came up with at the time. And this classmate of mine said, oh, yeah, I've actually read through everyone's, the notes, it's kind of unethical, but the notes from the admission day, you know, interview day for admissions, I could tell you what you said. And I was like, oh, sure, I would love to know. And it said, like, extremely articulate, you know, poised, and it, like, couldn't have been farther from, like, what my mind told me, you know, on the, you know, I went to graduate school in the Bronx. It couldn't have been farther from what I was thinking from the subway ride from the Bronx to the city and then for the remaining, like, 6 weeks till I heard back from the school. So it's just, it's sort of heartwarmingly silly how, or heartbreakingly silly, I should say, how our minds really hold us hostage for no reason. And rather than sort of getting stuck in this, like, quest for approval and from others to really try to find some sort of, like, place and space for forgiveness and compassion for ourselves.
It's really true. So tell me when you first got involved with mindfulness meditation.
That's a good question. I guess I first started through the physical practice of yoga. I'm from Los Angeles, and I started practicing yoga when I was a teenager. And I found it to be the first time that I really sort of slowed down and was in the moment. Even though I was sort of moving, it was the first time I sort of had, like, some quiet. And then through my psychology practice, a lot of the areas I specialize in are really rooted in mindfulness, like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and a practice called acceptance and commitment therapy, and also a treatment called dialectical behavior therapy, which requires a therapist mindfulness practice. All of them sort of require a therapist mindfulness practice, and really seeing sort of the profound benefits clinically in the research and also just personally knowing how helpful the practice is to me and my patients. And a big focus in the work is not only sort of having a daily sitting practice, but also really trying to participate fully in your life. So your like whole day is kind of like full of these meaningful experiences where your head and your body and your intention are all sort of aligned, and you're not, you know, talking to someone and thinking that, you know, they don't like you, or you're going for a run but thinking about all the mistakes you've made over the course of your life, but you're really just sort of head and heart in the moment.
Well, I can see that it's a great skill to have as a therapist and as you receive all of this. And it's also a great skill to impart, whether you do that directly or, you know, not. It's like, how does one deal with one's own mind, you know, when you see maybe a gravely maladaptive social cognition popping up, and it's really old and it's really kind of familiar, and it's so compelling, and yet you really know it's not true. We need some tools, right? We need some skills in order to see what's happening, not freak out about it, and be able to not follow down that path again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny. There's some like novel clinical applications that are a little bit different than what one may do at a mindfulness retreat, but that are still sort of linked to the same process of taking your mind less seriously. And one of my favorites is helping patients sing sort of these like the thoughts that really bother them. So one of my patients used to tell me a lot about thinking that he was a loser, you know, and like Saturday night, if he didn't have plans, his mind would like come pounding at the door with this story that he was a loser. And if he got some sort of sense of rejection from someone, or, you know, a hint of rejection, loser story came back in full force. And he, we worked on him singing. His favorite song was, you have to choose a song that's emotionally incongruent with the thought. He liked that song, Do You Believe in Magic?
Mm-hmm.
And so he would sing I'm a Loser to that tune. And I would sing it, even though my mind tells me not to, but I can barely remember how the tune goes, but it's a sort of upbeat tune. And that's sort of a way to be kind of mindful with a sort of a clinical focus, to just really, like, the second you start singing that thought, it sort of dissolves and you sort of, you know, are kind of like on top of a mountain rather than stuck in the mud.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's really similar to something that you've taught me about sort of seeing your mind the way an older person would watch children play.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of interesting.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, the thought can last like a second with a song like that. So I really enjoy helping my patients sing their thoughts, and that allows them to be more mindful in whatever it is they're doing.
So you came to loving kindness practice sometime later, right? After you'd already begun mindfulness practice.
I did, yeah. Actually, the first time I came to loving kindness meditation was at a retreat of yours that was the first time I studied with you. And I believe that was, I want to say, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. It was the first retreat that you did in with Ram Dass, I believe.
Oh.
2010.
On Maui or in Omega?
Yeah,
on
Maui.
Right. Okay, yeah.
I don't know if that was your first retreat with Ram Dass, but it was my first retreat with you. And I really loved it because one of my biggest personal challenges with mindfulness was like, I want to feel like I'm not just practicing for myself, but for like helping other people and feeling connected to people, and loving kindness was like one way that felt really fulfilling to sort of link my practice to sort of a better goodness. And I find it to be tremendously powerful and a huge part of what gives me the ability to connect with my patients and myself and people around me.
Wow. And do you actually teach the loving kindness practice?
I do. I actually teach my patients your practice of going through a series of people, and remarkably, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but loving kindness meditation is described in the dialectical behavior therapy skills training manual.
Really?
As one of the mindfulness skills. Yeah, I'll have to take a picture and send it to you.
I wonder if that's a later adaptation, because did Marshall Linehan sort of take DBT out of her Zen practice where loving kindness
she did.
Yeah.
She did, and in the revised one,
yeah.
The newest revision that came out, I believe, in 2015, there's a full page on loving kindness meditation, but I find it to be so helpful. And a lot of my patients that sort of have an aversion to sort of slowing down find it really helpful. And I think it really links nicely onto this idea of sort of coping ahead, like mental rehearsal to prepare oneself for a challenging event. And I feel like my patients teach me as much or more than I teach them at times. And it's pretty profound to see people that I work with practice loving kindness meditation for people that have grossly mistreated them, like caused horrific pain to them. And the forgiveness that they feel as a result of practicing loving kindness is really moving and meaningful and much richer than sort of feeling, holding on to the anger and the suffering.
Wow, that's fantastic. So there's a prescription if you're lonely or you're feeling really down and you don't have a date. Maybe it's meditation night, you know?
I love that. And I love what you also said about, like, even if you're meditating with, like, especially if you're meditating with a group of people, like, you're at a great party and you don't need to be talking or winning someone over with your, you know, great style and sense of humor, but you could just show up and sort of with kindness and interest, and that's enough.
Wow, that's so beautiful. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's a real honor. And for people that are listening and thinking, wow, I never could imagine being happy and really connected without a partner, that entirely makes sense given our cultural sort of conditioning. But it's pretty remarkable. I mean, there's actual research that finds that on average, marriage increases happiness by 1%.
Oh, good Lord.
and happiness is actually a much better way to sort of connect with other people. So a lot of people think first comes love, then comes happiness. But really, first comes happiness, then comes connection.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
So thank you for joining me today. And thank you for sharing such a positive and practical message. To learn more about Jenny and get a copy of How to Be Single and Happy, you can visit www.drjennytaitz.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her teaching schedule, please visit her website at sharonsalzberg.com.